For those of you who don't know me, my name is Ben. It is my joy to serve as the pastor here. You can follow along with the sermon I'm going to preach. On the inside of your bulletins, I'll have the scripture on one side and my notes on the other. Today, I want to talk to you about how when we can't escape grief, Jesus blesses it. And to explain to you what I mean by that, I want to talk to you a little bit about my grandparents, who I recently got to visit. If you were here a couple weeks ago, I told you that I got to see my grandparents down in Albuquerque, New Mexico. There's my grandma with my daughter. My grandparents are in their 90s, and I shared that it was actually really hard to see them. And part of what made it hard is that I remember my grandma before she was like this. Now, this is before I knew her, right? This is her as a young woman. She grew up in Mexico City. She is the daughter of a general, and she lived the high society socialite life down in Mexico City. My grandpa, his name is Cordell, and he's a good old boy from Oklahoma. And he had some trouble in college and needed to finish up some credits, and so he did summer school down in Mexico City. And there he went out partying and met this incredible woman who carried her father's command as a general onto the dance floor. And he was smitten. My grandpa tried to woo her in that moment, but she had been recently divorced. She had a young daughter who was my mom, and she thought, who's this random American? He's not serious. And so she kind of brushed him aside, and my grandpa Cordell spent a couple years traveling the world looking for oil reserves off the coast of Alaska, off the coast of Asia, off the coast of Africa. And after he did that, he came back to Mexico and wooed her once again, and this time she realized he was a little more serious about it. He went to her father, the general, and the general's like, why in the world are you, random American, interested in my daughter? And what Cordell said was, sir, I have traveled the world. Your daughter is the most beautiful woman in it. And so they got married. And Cordell brought my grandma Artemisa and my mom Patricia up to Albuquerque, New Mexico, where they lived for many years after that. And when I knew Artemisa, she looked like that picture. Oh, a little back. Go one back. There you go. Right? That's how I remember my grandma. This picture is taken about 10 years ago. Puerto Vallarta, she's probably about 80 years old. Vibrant, even into her 70s, my grandma would run 5 miles a day. In her 80s, she continued to do yoga daily. She is someone who loved to throw lavish parties. And as you can see, she is someone who has always taken great care with her physical appearance. This is in stark contrast to my father, who is with us tonight. My dad believes the only clothing worth buying is sold at a secondhand store. My grandma, on the other hand, I remember I went to Dillard's, a department store, with her as a child, and they're like, would you like to open up a credit card? And she said, sure. And they're like, okay, we'll open up a Dillard's credit card for you. Just so you know, it's only got a maximum credit limit of $10,000. And I said to her, grandma, how could you spend $10,000 on clothing? And she said, oh, Benja, I spend that in a single day. Bam! That's the grandma I knew, which is to say, when I go and visit her now, which is the next picture, it is painful to see how different she has become. And part of it is certainly a physical transformation. Now, instead of striding across a room, she shuffles with tiny steps. Part of it is that woman who used to care so much about her appearance is gone. She gives no mind to her dress. She rarely bathes, and it's only because my grandpa will give her sponge baths. Her hygiene is poor. When you get close, you can see her hair is greasy and dirty, and there's flakes of skin. And you can see she's clutching tissues. She's always grasping for more tissue papers. And I think it has something to do with her anxiety, which is a part of her I had never seen before. Now, when I go and visit her, I take my daughter, and my daughter wants to be in places where she can run around and make noise. And it used to be that Artemisa would love to be in a place where she could make noise because she would be the loudest of them all. But Now, after about 20 minutes in a place like that, she wants to leave, and she gets anxious and nervous, and part of how she deals with that is by chewing gum. She has this strange obsession with gum where she's always opening new packets of it and chewing it, and sometimes she'll take it out of her mouth and she'll put the gum somewhere else and she'll start chewing new gum, and then she'll take the old gum and mix it with her new gum and start chewing it again. And it's heartbreaking. And I think to myself, this can't be. I want to fix it, but I don't know how. In Paul's first letter to the Corinthians, he writes in chapter 1, verse 22, Jews ask for signs. And the Jewish people in Paul's day, they were looking for a sign to fix their big problem, which is that they were occupied by the Roman Empire. And they were looking for a sign from God. Signs are the way Jesus' miracles are described in the scriptures, particularly in John's gospel. They never call Jesus turning water into wine a miracle or raising Lazarus a miracle. It is a sign. It is a sign of what God is doing in their midst. And the Jews are looking for a sign that what God is doing is using force to overthrow the Romans who are occupying them, and they are ready to rally around an army that will do this. But here's the thing. As much as I would like to use force to have an army come and fix the situation, I don't think it can. Maybe I could convince my grandpa and my grandma to live differently. Maybe I could convince them to come to Chico where I could at least see them more often. But if I am honest with myself, I know how much time I would actually spend with them, and it's not enough. And so sometimes I think, well, maybe I could force my grandpa to put my grandma in a nursing facility where at least they would bathe her more regularly and she would be more clean. But my grandpa is someone who at his core loves freedom more than anything else. I remember he once told me, Ben, the last place a man can be free is on his sailboat. And he is the kind of guy, right? Remember, he's 93 years old. When I go and take my daughter to see him, we go to the playground, he climbs on the jungle gym with her. In December, my mom and I got real nervous because we were calling him and we couldn't get a hold of him and we didn't know where he was. Last time we saw him, he was in Albuquerque, New Mexico. The next time we saw him, we heard from Artemisa's brother who lives in central Mexico, 1,300 miles away, that he had gotten a ring on his doorbell. And when my great uncle opened his door, he saw a giant tow truck. And on the back of a tow truck was my grandma and grandpa's car with them inside it. Because my grandpa had decided, you know what, maybe it would be better if we moved back to Mexico. And without telling anyone, he just started driving. And I think to myself, how can I force this man to do anything other than call adult protective services? But if that happens, what it means is I am sending armed individuals to take my grandma away from my grandpa. And friends, right now in our country, we are seeing what happens when we try to solve a complex problem like immigration with brute force. It is messy and ugly. And friends, when the Jewish people look for a sign that they are to rise up and use force to solve their problems, they see one about a decade after Paul writes them a letter. But it's not really a sign from God. It is their own vanity. They rise up against the Roman Empire and are brutally crushed as a result. Jerusalem is burned to the ground, and Rome outlaws any Jewish person from returning there for hundreds of years. And so if we can't force a solution on the problem, what alternative is there? Well, in verse 22, Paul goes on to say, "For Jews ask for signs and Greeks desire wisdom." The Greeks are famous for their philosophy. And in the ancient world, there were two moments when Greek philosophy really took off. The first was during Alexander the Great's empire, and the second was during the Roman Empire. And scholars think there was a reason why philosophy got so popular during these empires, and it's that You know, the Greek people used to live in these little city-states where they would know everyone and they would have a say in society, but suddenly they were part of these multinational machines. And they felt like they didn't have any control over anything. But philosophy said, if you can't control anything else, we can teach you to control yourself. And Greek philosophy had two most popular strains. They're both of them had the same goal, which is to teach you how to be happy, to have peace of mind. One of them, Epicureanism, said the way to do that is to seek pleasure and avoid pain. And the best way to avoid pain is to only desire simple things that you can easily satisfy. Do that, and you'll be happy. The other popular strand of philosophy was Stoicism, and Stoicism says the way to be happy is to cultivate your own virtue so that you can master yourself. Terrible things may happen, but you don't have to feel terrible if you gain control of your emotion. And look, I think there is good things you can learn from both of these philosophies. And in fact, right now, Stoicism is once again becoming very popular, many people think, because there is some certain similarities to our country right now and the Roman Empire, that feeling of being out of control. But Stoicism is just one step away from people who revert to saying, you know what, I want to be happy, so good vibes only around here. Turn off the news. Don't tell me what's going on. I'm just going to focus on my fantasy football league, which is just a form of escapism. And I could do that with my grandma. I could say I want to prioritize my happiness and minimize my pain. And to do that, I'm going to stop visiting her because it makes me sad and it hurts my heart when I see her. So maybe I'll just stop looking in her direction. But friends, there are some people who don't have a choice, and they can't look away. Last Sunday, we were reading Matthew chapter 4, how Jesus begins his ministry after the arrest of John the Baptist, how he calls the fishermen to be his disciples, and how he goes healing people who are sick, and how crowds gather from all the surrounding countries to bring to him the people who are most ravaged by illness. These are people who can't look away. They don't get vacations. They don't subscribe to Netflix. There's nowhere for them to escape. And so when we can't escape from grief, Jesus blesses it. Seeing those crowds gather round, Jesus goes up a mountain and he preaches his most famous sermon. And in his Sermon on the Mount, Jesus says, who is blessed? And he divides the people who are into blessed into eight basic categories. And you can think of those basic categories as divided into two parts: those who refuse to flee their grief, and those who refuse to use force to try to fix it. Jesus starts with those who refuse to flee in Matthew chapter 5, starting at verse 2. He began to speak, and he taught them, saying, blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. It's interesting. In Greek, the word that's translated as poor literally means someone who crouches, like a beggar lifting up their hands in hopes that they will be given something. To be poor in spirit is to have your spirit so low that all you can do is hope that there is some crumb of goodness. These are people who are poor in spirit because they are honest about what is happening in their lives. Jesus says, blessed are those who mourn, for they will be comforted. Those who mourn not just the grief in their own life, but their grief for what they see in the world around them. Jesus says, blessed are the meek, for they will inherit the earth. And I want to talk a little bit about that word meek. In some other places, it's translated as humble, which I think is a better translation, because I think when we hear the word meek, we think of someone who doesn't speak up or make a fuss. But in Numbers chapter 12, it says that Moses was the meekest man on the face of the earth. And if you've read the book of Exodus, describing Moses as meek seems like a stretch. This is a man who actually killed an Egyptian soldier for abusing a fellow Israelite. This is a man who stood before Pharaoh and said, "Let my people go." This is a man who parted the Red Sea and led his people to freedom. How is Moses meek? Well, it calls him meek immediately after Moses recognizes that he is struggling to lead God's people. And God says essentially, well, it's because you're trying to do it all yourself. And God says, I will send my spirit not just on you, Moses, but on 70 other folks. And his buddy Joshua says, Moses, doesn't that make you jealous that now other people have God's spirit flowing through them? Moses says, no, I wish that every single person had the power of the Spirit to prophesy and speak God's word. It would be so much better. And when God calls Moses meek, it is when his brother and sister Aaron and Miriam criticize Moses and say, you know, God talks to us too. And Moses says, you're right, God does. Moses' meekness is not a quietness, is not a refusal to stand up for what's right. Moses' meekness is a recognition that he is not the only solution to what is wrong in this world. That is what it means to be meek, which is why Jesus himself calls himself meek. He calls himself meek when he invites us to take his yoke upon us. Because a yoke is something that's used to connect two animals so that they can pull a plow together. Even Jesus is saying, this can't be just about me. You have to be a part of this too. To be meek is to say, I can't be the only solution to what is wrong. And that belief that I am is part of the problem. Blessed are the meek. Goes on to say, blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, for they will be filled. In English, we distinguish righteousness from justice. We think of righteousness as being in right relationship with God, and justice as in being in right relationship with our neighbors. But in Greek, the words for justice and righteousness are the same word. There's no difference in being in relationship with God properly and in being in relationship with your neighbor properly. To recognize that there is something wrong with this world and to mourn for it, to be low in spirit for it, to say, I am not enough for it, still leads us to hunger and thirst for a world in which those right relationships exist. It calls us to action. But the question is, how will we act? Which is the second four of the Beatitudes. Jesus says, blessed are the merciful, for they will receive mercy. In this world that is so wrong, our temptation is, these people have done bad to me, I will do bad to them. But Jesus says, God's blessings are for those who choose a different way, who choose to be the change they want to see in the world. Jesus goes on to say, blessed are the pure in heart, for they will see God. To be pure in heart is to say what is wrong in this world will not lead me to act in anger or hatred towards another, but in love for what should be. And that purity of heart allows people to be peacemakers. Now, to be clear, in Jesus' time, Caesar claimed to be a peacemaker. They had this idea of the Pax Romana, the Roman peace that brought peace to the Mediterranean. And the way Caesar brought peace to the Mediterranean was to kill anyone who disagreed with him. But in Hebrew, the word for peace is shalom. And shalom means wholeness. And this is the peacemaker that Jesus refers to, the one who makes peace not by destroying the other, but by healing them and making them whole. They say history is written by the victors, but Jesus goes on to say, blessed are you who are persecuted for the sake of righteousness, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are you when people revile you and persecute you and utter all kinds of evil against you falsely on my account. Rejoice and be glad, for your reward is great in heaven, for in the same way they persecuted the prophets who were before you. If you are going to bring peace through healing instead of through conquest, there are going to be people who don't accept your version of history or events. And they will say mean things about you and what you are doing. That is the price you pay for not silencing those you are in opposition to. Jesus says, blessed are those people. And in the eyes of the world, this list of blessings is hard to swallow. In fact, Paul goes on to say, after the Jews ask for signs and the Greeks desire wisdom, but we proclaim Christ crucified, a stumbling block to Jews and foolishness to Gentiles. Paul is saying the cross is God doing the Beatitudes, God's self. On the cross, God says, I am not going to look away from all the pain and suffering in this world. I am going to be present to it, even if that means I have to experience that pain and suffering myself. I will not use force to make you all my puppets doing what I want you to do. Instead, I will let you break me so that I can be with you in your brokenness. To which the world says, what good is that? This is a stumbling block to Jews and foolishness to Gentiles. But Paul says, but to those who are called, both Jews and Greeks, Christ, the power of God, Christ is the power of God and the wisdom of God. For God's foolishness is wiser than human wisdom, and God's weakness is stronger than human strength. I have seen that to be true. I have seen it in my grandfather. I have seen it in my grandfather who is blessed because even though he knows there will never again be romance with his wife, every time he steps out of the car, he extends his arm to her as a gentleman and they walk together. He is blessed because even as he sees that she has not bathed once again this week, he still leans in to give her a kiss on her forehead. He is blessed because even though he knows 20 minutes after they arrive, she will want to leave, he still takes her to concerts in the park. He is blessed because 3 times a day he stops by convenience stores and grocery stores to buy the gum that she cries for like a child almost hourly. He is blessed because he will drive 2,600 miles round trip in recognition that he himself is not enough to give her what she needs. And so he will go in search of a place where there are people who will bring her peace. He is blessed because every member of our family criticizes how he cares for the love of his life. And yet not one of them will step up to do the work that he does. I say that he is blessed because he sees my grandmother, not from an earthly perspective, but from heaven's perspective. He sees my grandmother not as the woman she is now, but as the woman heaven intends her to be, full of life and vibrancy and strength. He sees her this way even as he walks with her in her brokenness. And that tension of having his head in heaven and his feet on earth, it tears him apart just as it did Jesus on the cross. For on the cross, Jesus committed to seeing us as saints even as he walked with us as sinners. And that tension between what heaven knows and what earth allows, it tore Jesus apart on the cross. But friends, as Paul says in 1 Corinthians 1:18, the message about the cross is foolishness to those who are perishing, but to us who are being saved, it is the power of God. For when we have learned to trust in that cross, what we have learned is that breaking of God is the outpouring of God's love, a love that can endure anything, even death. And it is that love which gives us the only wisdom that can bring us joy and gives us the only strength that can set us free. My grandpa, he may not be able to keep my grandma as clean as she would be in a facility, but he loves her more than any place ever could. She gets to experience the kingdom of heaven with him because she knows what it is to be loved beyond imagining, even in her brokenness. And that is what Jesus does for us. Everyone I know right now is poor in spirit. Some of us because of what's happening in our personal lives. Some of us because of what's happening in the public sphere. And the temptation is to either look away, to flee what is wrong, or to say, I am going to come at it with force and just demand that people accept my solution. But those don't work. I say that also acknowledging we need time to rest, to lay down our burdens, and we need to address the things that can be fixed. There is profound truth to the Serenity Prayer, which asks God to give us the serenity to accept the things we cannot change, the strength to change the things we can, and the wisdom to know the difference. But sometimes, friends, there are things that are unacceptable and we cannot fix. And in that moment, what Christ invites us to do is to let our hearts be broken, to neither flee nor force a solution, but to live in the tension that tears us apart until what flows from our heart is that love that comes from God on the cross. The only true wisdom, the only true strength, which can give us life and set us free. Amen.